Last fall when I started Matthew, I thought it would be just a month or so. This time we're going to do something that we expect to take us a little while. A lot of you have been praying over the last several months what we should study next. About a year and a half ago, the Lord laid in my heart and confirmed it as I talked to several people that we ought to spend some time looking at the book of Ecclesiastes, which is not one of the more preached books in the Bible. How many of you have ever heard a series of sermons on Ecclesiastes? I've taken my hand down because I haven't. Have you ever heard a series of sermons on Ecclesiastes? How many of you have ever heard a sermon on Ecclesiastes? There's one. Okay. Francis has. And I actually heard one once upon a time, which was a very good sermon and really opened my eyes to a whole new way of looking at the book. Well, we're going to do a series on Ecclesiastes. We'll go through it. There are 12 chapters. If I did a chapter on Lord's Day, that would be 3 months right there, and I expect it will take me between 2 and 3 Sundays for some chapters. So we'll be here for a better part of a year, I expect. Today, I'm not going to start going through line by line. Instead, I'd like to say a few words to you about the title of the book, its authorship, and 5 major themes that seem to be repeated over and over through it, and then try to give you the big idea, the big message of Ecclesiastes as I see it. And then we'll see if that really works out to be true as we go through the 12 chapters of this book over the next months together. I'll start with the title of the book, Ecclesiastes. You've probably never heard that term used for anything other than the title of this particular book. And so if I were to say to you Ecclesiastes, you would say, yeah, that book right there. Actually, though, Ecclesiastes is not the name of a book. It is the title of a person. It comes from the same Greek word as the one from which we get church. Ekklesia means church, or more basically, assembly, a gathering together. And Ecclesiastes is someone who is the member of one of these things. He's a person who's a member of an assembly. Now, you could say of each of you that you are an Ecclesiastes. Actually, though, this is taken from the Hebrew term, which you see in the very first verse of the book, the words of the preacher. Now, that word preacher is the Hebrew word kohelet. And when that got translated into Greek, they translated it as Ecclesiastes. The kohelet is certainly a member of a group like this. And he is in particular the person who calls the group together and addresses it. So if we translated the title of the book, we should call it the preacher. And in fact, you probably see that under Ecclesiastes in your Bible. It says Ecclesiastes or the preacher, because that's what Ecclesiastes means. The distinguished member of the assembly. The one who calls it together, the preacher. There's one slight modification that I have to make in giving you that title for it, though. Almost always in the book, the Hebrew text does not talk about the preacher. It simply talks about preacher. Same kind of thing that happens in the New Testament, where sometimes we read of the Christ, and sometimes we read of Christ. The word Christ is a title. It means Messiah or anointed one. And strictly speaking, should be used with the article. You should talk about the anointed one. But it comes to be used so often that it becomes like a proper name. You know, we can talk about the student, but we never talk about the Francis. Is Francis the student? You know, we talk about the engineer, but we talk about Dave, not the Dave. If you use an article, you're talking about a title. If you leave the article off, it becomes a name. And that's what's happened here. This book is about Mr. Preacher. Not the preacher, but somebody whose name is being called Preacher. To avoid confusion, I will often simply call him Kohelet. That's his name. And if we use something that sounds like a name, maybe we'll think of it as a name, because that's the main character in this book. Think of him as a fellow named Kohelet, Mr. Preacher. Kohelet, in turn, comes from the Hebrew word kahal, which means assembly. We're right back here again. And it's commonly used in the Old Testament to describe the nation Israel. In fact, you'll often see on synagogues titles like Kohelet Yisrael, the Assembly of Israel. That ought to tell us something about this character who is writing to us here. He is taking the position as one who has summoned God's people together. He has summoned the Kahal, the Assembly of God, and he has some important advice to give them. He has some instructions for them. Well, who is Kohelet? Who is Mr. Preacher? Obviously, that's not the name of any character that we know in the Old Testament. Furthermore, it's not a term that's used in the rest of the Old Testament. We don't have lots of Kohelets running around. It's only in this book that we have this expression. It's being used for literary effect by the writer, but who is this? The tradition of the church and the synagogue has always been that the author of the book was Solomon. That's a consistent tradition. However, it's important for us to recognize that the book nowhere says that. The book nowhere names Solomon as its author. There are some very strong hints, though, that show rather unequivocally that Solomon is intricately bound up with this book. For example, chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, or Mr. Preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So there is some descendant of David who wrote this, who is king in Jerusalem. Verse 13, I'll start with verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. So this person has an emphasis on wisdom. So, son of David, king in Jerusalem, or at least according to verse 12, he was king in Jerusalem. The fact that that's in the past tense has caused some confusion. If this really is Solomon, by the time he died, he was still king in Jerusalem. It wasn't that he was king in Jerusalem and then stopped being king in Jerusalem. It's interesting that the Jewish sages, reading verse 12 and wanting to attribute this book to Solomon, devised a theory that toward the end of his life, because of his many sins, God took Solomon off the throne and caused him to wander around the city as a beggar, from which position he wrote this book and told everybody, I was king in Jerusalem. And then, to make sure that nothing would get upset, God put an angel on the throne who looked exactly like Solomon. I, Mr. Preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, involved greatly with wisdom. Look at chapter 12, verses 9 and 10 at the end of the book. Moreover, because Mr. Preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. Mr. Preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. This, of course, is right in line with what the Bible tells us about Solomon, that he was much concerned with wisdom, and that he had a gift from God for wisdom. He asked for wisdom when God offered him whatever he would pray for. In 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29, I have a verse that sounds an awful lot like chapter 12, verse 9 of Ecclesiastes. God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men. Then it gives a list of some very famous wise men. Verse 32, he spake 3,000 proverbs. His songs were 1,005, and he spake of trees, from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spake also of beasts, and of fowl, and of creeping things, and of fishes, and there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. So we know Solomon here is a collector of proverbs, and that's what we're told in Ecclesiastes 12:9. He taught the people knowledge, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. We'll see a lot of those proverbs as we go through the book. Much of Ecclesiastes is made up of proverbs. There would be no reason not to think that this was written by Solomon, well, except for that funny verse about I was king in Jerusalem. If it weren't for the fact that the language of this book is extremely strange, it's not at all like Proverbs, it's not at all like the Song of Solomon, the other two books that bear Solomonic ascription, in fact, that are explicitly in the text said to be by Solomon. Sometimes it's said that it's a very late form of Hebrew. Solomon lived 10 centuries before Christ. Some people say this Hebrew is more like the Hebrew that was written 4 centuries before Christ. Think how different English was 600 years ago from what it is now. And you get some idea of the kind of differences here. But the trouble is, this book is not like the books that were written 400 years before Christ either. It's not like any other Hebrew that we have. It's very, very different stuff. The best we can probably say about this book is that the thought is Solomon's thought. He might have written it, in which case he used a very strange style of Hebrew to do it, perhaps because this particular form of literature was supposed to be written in a very particular style, much as legal language is different from ordinary language. Perhaps somebody else is setting down here ideas and thoughts that are basically Solomon's thoughts and describing them accurately as coming from this man who was king in Jerusalem and putting them into his mouth, maybe some years after Solomon has passed on. So here it's almost as though Solomon has come back to advise us from the other side of the grave how we should live. Doesn't really matter when it was written. I want you to understand the association with Solomon's thought. And I think it's also important for us to understand that the Holy Spirit has placed this book in the Bible for us. It's part of our canon of Scripture. It's part of the books that we, as believers, accept as authoritative. Now, this is an important thing to understand because a lot of people would just as soon scrap the book of Ecclesiastes, including some of the Jewish sages in the first century. They debated over whether this book really belonged in the Bible or not. It wasn't. I mean, it was there. They had to face the fact that it was there. They weren't deciding whether to put it in. It was clearly there, but they were wondering how come because of some of the strange things that it said. You'll see a little trace of that if you have a Scofield Bible and you read his notes on this book. Mr. Scofield's attitude is that this book is given to us to show us the best that the unaided carnal mind can do apart from God. It's an example of worldly wisdom, not something that we are to emulate or follow, but just an example of the very best you can do apart from a good understanding of God's ways with man. As one writer has observed, if that's all this book is for, why did God bother to put it in the Bible? If it's just here as an example of how not to think about life, you've got plenty of those examples. You can pick up a newspaper any day of the week and get all of that you want in just one day's newspaper for 25 cents. Why put it in the Bible? Why preserve it for all time for God's people? I think the book deserves better attention than that. And in fact, as we go through it, we'll find that it is completely consistent with what the rest of the Scriptures teach. It is an Old Testament book. It does not enjoy the full light of revelation that we have in the New Testament. And in that way, it's no different from any other Old Testament book. I suppose almost every book in the Old Testament has limitations in its ideas, in its theology, that are clarified only when you get to the New Testament. But apart from that qualification, that it was written under the Old Covenant rather than under the New, we'll find, I think, that the ideas and thoughts of this book are completely consistent with the rest of Scripture and are a reliable and important guide for us today. Let's talk about some of the themes of the book of Ecclesiastes then. I've pulled out five that I'd like to highlight for you. The first one is the theme of vanity. You don't have to read very far before you get it. Verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith Mr. Preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Verse 14. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Or, as that phrase can alternately be translated, a chasing after wind. Did you ever try to catch the breeze? I mean, little children sometimes cry for the moon at night. Well, at least the moon is concrete. Did you ever go out and try to catch the breeze and put it in the bag? Can't do it. And that's what all of life is like, he says. Chapter 2, verse 11. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and chasing the breeze. Chapter 2, verse 17. Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and chasing the breeze. Verse 26. Very last line. This also is vanity and chasing the breeze. And you can find it in chapter 4, chapter 6. Look how chapter 12 summarizes the matter. Verse 8. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. All is vanity. This particular Hebrew word, vanity, hevel, literally means wind or breath. But it's very seldom used in that sense. More often it's used to mean something that has no more substance than wind or breath. It's a vapor. You know, it's like what comes out of your mouth on a cold day and it dissipates away. Like the steam from a tea kettle. Nothingness. The words often used in the prophets to describe the idols. The false idols are called hevel, or vanity, because they are nothing. They're insubstantial. They have an appearance, but there's nothing really there. Ecclesiastes does not use this word to talk about idols. It uses it to talk about all of life. And it says all of life really amounts to no more than the steam that comes out of your mouth on a cold day. It's emptiness. It's nothingness. This is his verdict on everything under the sun. All your Christmas presents are nothing. All the time you spend at work or at school, it's like vapor on a cold day. The great American dream, your own home with a green lawn and a white picket fence, vanity, emptiness, nothing. It sounds pretty discouraging, doesn't it? But you know, he's not the only one who says that. Look at Romans chapter 8, verse 20. Romans 8:20, Paul tells us that the creation, King James word creature here means that which is created, the dead things, the rocks and stones, as well as the living things. The creation was made subject to vanity. The creation, or as Mr. Preacher would say, all that is under the sun. Paul says it was made subject to vanity. Where do you think Paul got this idea from, that the entire created order is vain? You think he made it up? No, he's reading Kohelet. He's listening to Mr. Preacher. This isn't ungodly pessimism, folks. This is good New Covenant truth. The whole creation, everything under the sun, is empty. It's vain. And if you read Paul here, it's clear that what he's talking about is the results of sin, the results of the fallen world in which we live. So that's one thing to keep in mind about this. Another thing I was rather surprised to learn. You've seen this word before, but not spelled quite this way. You've seen it spelled this way, but it's exactly the same Hebrew word. Who's that? It's Adam and Eve's younger son, the brother of Cain. We call him Abel. His Hebrew name is Hevel. That is vanity. There's a little imagery in his name there, because his life was so short. You know, he was born, he offered a sacrifice to God, and then he was snuffed out, wiped away by his brother, murdered brutally, didn't have a chance to have a family or children or anything, like a breath. He appears for a moment, and he vanishes. Vanity. Something that could have been good turned into nothing because of the effect of sin. And yet, if you stop to think, some of the things that we considered last Lord's Day evening at the breaking of bread about this character, about Abel, that little short puff of life that might seem so inconsequential embodies some tremendous truths in the New Testament. It tells us some very important things about God's dealings with us. And in a way, that's what we're going to find out about this vanity in the book of Ecclesiastes, too. All of life is vain, it's empty, and yet inside it there is this little nucleus of godly significance that we can find and cling to that'll give us meaning in our lives. The world is vain, empty because of sin. But, as in the case of Abel's vanity, there is a little kernel there that we can hang on to. That's the first big idea, the idea of vanity. Emptiness, nothingness. Second big idea is the idea of travail, or a very difficult task to do, And this is a task that God has given to us. Chapter 1, verse 13. I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Sound familiar? It's the Charter of the University of Michigan. To search and seek out all things that are done under heaven. That's what the modern university is all about, isn't it? This, and it goes all the way back to the Greeks. This notion of man as inquiring, as curious, as driven by these insatiable questions that he just has to have answered. I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. And now read the next sentence. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. That is a task that God has given to man. God has given man the task of understanding the world around him. He's given us this driving urge to understand everything around us. But Mr. Preacher calls it a sore travail, a very painful labor. And the reason is that we are doomed to failure in it. Chapter 3, verse 10. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in its time. Not his time, but its time. Everything has its own time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart. He has put, another way of rendering this Hebrew word is eternity. He has given us this huge void in our hearts to want to inquire about everything in space, everything in time. And yet we read on, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. He's given us this task. Go understand the world. And yet, because he is the sovereign Lord of the world and we are finite and limited, we can never succeed in that task. And so we work and we study harder and harder and we never find all the answers. Chapter 8, verse 17. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. It's a catch-22. God has given you an undoable job to do. He has placed within you a longing, a drive to understand your world, to explore, to figure out the questions of life, and yet you never can. Not completely, not really. Because he holds the key. He hasn't given it to you. You're only finite. He's infinite. It's in principle impossible for you to understand all that God is doing in the world. A footnote here. I think it's impossible for us to know that Solomon's wisdom didn't come to him for free. He depicts himself in this book as exerting a tremendous amount of effort in gaining wisdom. We know that God promised him wisdom. It's clear from this book and from Proverbs as well that Solomon really worked at that wisdom. God gave him an aptitude for wisdom, but he studied and sought out and thought about it. His whole life was marked by the exercise of this travail. Now the third theme that runs through this book is one of anomalies. You know what an anomaly is? Something that seems to be internally inconsistent or contradictory. For example, chapter 9, verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Saw that during the Olympics, didn't we? We saw athletes who, for every reason, ought to have won, and yet they didn't. Because of some quirk of fate. Chapter 3, verse 16. A particularly troublesome anomaly. The confusion of righteousness and wickedness. Moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment. That wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. Where there should be righteousness, there is wickedness. Chapter 7, verse 15. All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his wickedness. The righteous wiped out, the wicked prospering and prolonging their lives, often at the very expense of the righteous man. And yet, Mr. Preacher has a firm faith that God is going to correct these anomalies someday. He doesn't see this quite as clearly as we can in the light of the New Testament. His perception of what comes beyond the grave is a little clouded, as it is throughout the Old Testament. But there is an underlying faith. Chapter 3, verse 17. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I've got to believe, he says, that God is ultimately going to bring judgment and he's going to straighten out these anomalies. Chapter 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. Let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. You will have to answer. One day there will be an accounting. Chapter 12, verse 14. God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. So there are anomalies in the world. Mr. Preacher doesn't understand them. But he's confident that someday God is going to straighten it out somehow. Now the next big theme that we see here is God's sovereignty and man's futility. These are complementary truths, but we rarely talk about them as such. We often talk about God's sovereignty, the fact that God can do anything he wants to, the fact that he is completely free and unconstrained. There's a complementary truth here, which is that man cannot reliably be counted on to do anything. I guess it comes closest to classical expression in the notion of the total depravity of man, but Mr. Preacher is not concerned here with theological terms like total depravity. He's concerned here with how come you can go out and work and work and work and try as hard as you can and still not get what you're trying for. In the aggregate, hard work pays off. That is, if you look at 100 people who try hard and 100 people who don't try hard, the 100 people who try hard on average will do better than the 100 people who don't try hard. But for any given individual, time and chance happens to them all. Man's efforts are futile. Let's look at God's sovereignty. Chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. Whatever God does, that's it. You cannot affect, you cannot change God's purpose. Chapter 7, verse 13. Consider the work of God. For who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Can't. Can't be done. Chapter 8, verse 17. We read this one before. I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. You can't even understand it, much less affect it. God does it, and you stand there and scratch your head about it, and that's about as far as you get. So God is sovereign, and man's efforts basically are futile. Chapter 2, verse 17. Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and chasing the breeze. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me, and who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Here I work real hard. What for? I earn a lot of living. Do I know whether my children will spend their inheritance wisely or foolishly? In fact, in our days we have less and less to worry about inheritance, don't we? The government takes it all. And we know how the government will spend it all. Not a question of wisely at all. Or I labor to build a big organization. I labor in my employment to make something and establish it, and someday I'm going to pass away and someone else is going to take it over, whether it's my group or my department or my company. and who knows how it's going to turn out. I can't guarantee the success of it. Chapter 3, verse 9. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? And the answer is none. None. You work like mad. And what good happens from it? Nothing. Chapter 4, verse 4. Again I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. You work hard, and maybe God gives you some success, and the guy next to you looks at you, and he's jealous. And that's what you get for all of your hard work. Is somebody angry with you now because you worked so hard, and now he's jealous? This is also vanity and chasing the breeze. Chapter 5, verse 10. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. The more you have, the more you'll want. It will not satisfy you. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. The more you have, the more expenses you'll find. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? The only thing they're good for is to look at them. Oh, they look so pretty. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. He's so worried about somebody breaking in and stealing all that he's accumulated that he loses sleep at night worrying about how to protect it. Certainly this fits his conclusion. It's vanity. Chasing after breeze. You know, Ecclesiastes is a real good book for workaholics to read. Because it reminds us that our careers are, they're emptiness. They're chasing after the breeze. We have to provide for our families. We are to be diligent. This book will exhort us to be diligent. This is the book that says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. At the same time, this book says, don't take yourself so seriously, folks. It's all emptiness. It doesn't amount to a hill of beans in eternity's terms. The world is empty like a breeze. God's given us this impossible task to do. He's set within us an insatiable desire to understand our situation, and yet we cannot find the answer. In fact, all we find are anomalies. God indeed is sovereign. He's in control. Our labors, on the other hand, are futile, empty, doomed to frustration. Now, where do we go from this? We could go into depression, but that's not where Mr. Preacher leaves us. One overwhelming conclusion that he draws over and over and over again through the book is that we should enjoy good from the hand of God. Chapter 2, verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. Chapter 3, verse 12. I know that there is no good in them but for a man to rejoice and do good in his life. And again, 3:22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Chapter 8, verse 15. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry, for that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life which God giveth him under the sun. Chapter 9, verse 7. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy. Drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. Let thy garments be always white, let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun all the days of thy vanity, for that is thy portion in this life and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. This is God's blessing to you. This is God's gift to you. When you sit down to dinner, enjoy your meal. You know, the French and the Israelis, I suppose continental people in general, have a custom that we don't have at our tables. When we sit down to eat, we thank God for our food. Now, you should do that. They don't. You should. The Israelis do, but not the French. But they say something that maybe we ought to say. In French, they say bon appétit. In Israel, they say b'tei avon. In English, we would say enjoy your meal. That's what he's saying. Every time you sit down to eat, enjoy it. Here is God's blessing. Enjoy it. Be happy. Enjoy the small things in life, the little pleasures that God gives us. That's all there is, folks. Don't expect that you're going to get fulfillment from your philosophical investigations. That's a sore travail. Don't think that you're going to solve all the great mysteries of life. All you're going to find are anomalies that are resolved only beyond the grave and into eternity. Don't think that by your effort you're going to build something big and wonderful. Your efforts are futile. All you've got are the little things that you've got right now. So take them from God's hand. Relax and enjoy them. Chapter 11, verse 7. Truly, the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man live many years, then rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. Let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Don't be irresponsible. Don't think that I'm telling you to go off and live to satisfy your pleasures. I'm not. You'll have to answer to God. But rejoice in what he gives you. Remove sorrow from thy heart. Put away evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. Don't confuse this with the saying of the Corinthians, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. That's not what Mr. Preacher is saying at all. He's not saying eat and drink because tomorrow comes death. He's saying eat and drink, this is what God gives you. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17 is very close, in fact, to the idea that we've seen in this series of verses. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches. Don't put their trust in wealth. That's right down the line of what Mr. Preacher has been saying. But rather to trust in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. Why does God give blessings to us? So that we can make ourselves great? So that we can show off to other people about how rich we are? No. He gives us good things so that we can enjoy them. That's why he gives them to us. Must not trust in the riches. We must trust in the God who gives the riches. In sum, what's the big idea of Ecclesiastes? I think the big idea of this book is that there are two errors that we can make as believers in a fallen world. And Mr. Preacher wants to warn us against both of these errors. The first error I call the Pollyanna error. That is the error of saying, oh, the world is lovely, I'm comfortable, everything is fine, there are no problems around. Listen, folks, the world is fallen, and the effects of the fall surround us on every side. And it's not godly to pull a stocking over your head and say, I don't see any problems. It's not godly to stick your head in the sand and pretend that everything is hunky-dory. It isn't. The world stinks. Life is really the pits. Kohelet has the courage to look life straight in the face and tell it like it is. Wake up, folks. This is really a miserable world. You know why it's miserable. It's miserable because of sin. It's the fall that's all around us. But here's why you must have a realistic view of the world you live in and not pretend that it's really wonderful. Think first of all about our Lord weeping over Jerusalem. If you don't realize how bad it is out there, you're never going to have the concern for people and the zeal to tell them about the good things that God has waiting. If you think this world is basically an okay place to be, you'll leave them content there, and what's worse, you'll become content there yourself. You know, Paul tells us to set our affection on things above, not on things on the earth. Well, it's a lot easier to do that if you have an accurate perception of just how lousy things on the earth really are. And Kohelet will give us that perception. He'll guard us from falling into the Pollyanna error. He'll also guard us from falling into the pessimism error. When you do look the world straight in the face and see how terrible life is, there's a temptation, a tendency to become depressed, pessimistic, discouraged. He won't allow us to do that either. He urges us to recognize that though we do beat our heads against the wall, our efforts are futile. We cannot figure things out still. God is in control. He's using this fallen world to accomplish His purposes. And in the midst of all the disaster, in the midst of everything going wrong, day by day, He gives us little tokens of His care. A pleasant meal here, a loving family here, good companionship here, a thought from His Word in the morning here. If we can get our eyes off of all this terrible stuff here that is so discouraging in itself, we have to know it's there. We have to face its existence. But if our preoccupation can be not with that, but rather with God, and we see the little things He gives us day by day, then we can rejoice. We can be joyful. Not because the world is such a great place to live, but because our God is taking care of us. These, I think, are the lessons that we'll see unfolded over the months ahead as we work our way through this book. I'm looking forward to studying it. As I say, I've never done it before. I've never heard it done before. But I believe God has much to teach us as we go through it together. Let's sing in closing from our hymnals number 271, which embodies a lot of this basic idea. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, Thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. Written by a man who had just learned that his family had been lost in an accident at sea. He wrote this hymn to express his thanks to God for what in his case was the one little thing that he was able to cling to, the knowledge that his sin was taken away. He recognized the difficulty and suffering of the world and at the same time was able to rejoice in one particular blessing of God to him. Number 271, let's stand and sing together.